If you did not know the story, you would have thought that where we are in the book of Exodus would have been the time for great celebration. Because the people had gone forth out of Egypt. The people of Egypt had given them all kinds of good stuff on the way out. It looked like victory had been accomplished. They were on their way. Praise the Lord. Nothing could stop them now. Well, almost nothing, except for the Egyptian army. Exodus chapter 13, down in verse 17. Now when Pharaoh had let the people go, God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, even though it was near. For God said, the people might change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. Hence God led the people around by the way of the wilderness to the Red Sea. And the sons of Israel went up in martial array from the land of Egypt. I like those two verses. Actually, verse 17 I like quite a bit. It has always bothered me. Well, I can't say always. It has sometimes bothered me. In the parable that Yeshua tells about the 10 talents, where two men were entrusted with 10 talents, and one was entrusted with one, I believe. Maybe just one. One of each. But anyway, the one with one talent went away and buried it. And the idea there was that you be faithful with what you got. And I've struggled from time to time, because there was a third person that you could think of in that parable that was never mentioned, and that was the person that was entrusted with one talent, and rather than burying it, he tried to invest it and lost it anyway, because of his incompetence. And always it strikes me from time to time, it's like, well, suppose God gives somebody a job to do, and they're just not competent to do it. I mean, they want to do it. They've got a heart to do it. But they just can't get it done. They just don't have the ability to do it. And the answer from this passage, really, is that, well, that's not a legal question. Because if a person wasn't up to the job, God wouldn't give them the job. The people of Israel were not up to the task of conquering the Philistines at this point, or the sea peoples along the coast. I mean, they were tough stuff. Think, really, the precursors. They were probably Minoans and the precursors of the Greeks. And these are the people who later on would conquer most of the Mediterranean. This is tough stuff you're talking about. And so God said, well, I could take them up that way and insist that they have the faith to accomplish it, knowing that they're going to fail, or I could just take them the other way. So God took them the other way. And that to me is absolutely astounding, that an all-powerful God would be conscious enough of the weakness of men and women that he would accommodate his plan, because he detoured them from his plan. His plan was always that the descendants of Jacob, the descendants of Israel, the Israelites, the Jewish people, would have the land. That was his plan. And if I were the planner, for instance, if I'm a manager in a company and I want somebody to accomplish something, I think of the most efficient way of doing it. Go do it. Take the land. Philistines, who cares about the Philistines? I'll take care of the Philistines, you just go. God didn't do that. He actually said, these people are never going to make it through there. And so he let them go the longer route. How much in our own lives that God does that for us, even when we don't realize it? And sometimes we look at our lives and we look at, you know, what we perceive to be God's plan for us, and we're thinking, man, you know, I can see that plan. I want to go do it. And instead, we find ourselves detouring in the opposite direction, saying, God, what's going on? Why'd you do this to me? Well, most likely the answer is because you weren't ready to take the direct route. And if you took the direct route, you'd go running screaming off into the desert. It's just not going to happen. So we're going to take you the easy way. We're going to take you the back way. You're not ready to drive on the Beltway yet. We're going to take you the back way. We're going to teach you on side streets, and then once you learn the side streets, then we'll take you on the Beltway. And that's what he's doing with these people. He said, you're not ready for the big time yet. We're going to take you down these side streets and get you ready. But God would allow them to do that. So that also says that all the things, the trials that these people were going to undertake from here on out, even in today's section, they should have been able to handle it. God, who wired each and every one of their brains. Sometimes I fancily think that somewhere in heaven there's this, you know, this file, the schematics for everybody's brain and existence, that God could just, you know, pull out the drawer and look at it and say, oh yeah, right there. That's how he's wired up. That he knew how each and every one of these people were wired up. That he knew that if they put their mind to it, they could get through every single one of the trials that he was going to set before them successfully. In our life, the same thing. He looks at us, looks at his plan, says, this person will fit here exactly. And so there we are. We are plugged into that plan there. Nowhere else. We don't take a 12-volt laptop plug and just, and don't try this at home, just split out the wires and say, well, I don't have my charger with me. I'm just going to plug into the electric outlet directly. What happens next isn't going to be fun. I guess it depends on how much you like putting out fires. And God doesn't do that. He doesn't plug us into a place we're not belong. And where we don't belong, we're not equipped to. He plugs us in exactly where we need to be. And where these people needed to be was not in Philistia. He's going to take them down by the way of the wilderness to the Red Sea. By the way, a moment's pause here to talk about the site of the crossing, what this Red Sea was all about. People have gone back and forth about this, about the fact that the Hebrew is Yam Suf. People have translated that different ways, and the historical critical movement, which was far more critical than it was historical, but don't get me started, another button you don't want to push, tried to make this sound like some sort of marshland somewhere. But yet, in my reading, there are other issues in Egyptian thinking where they just called the Sea of Reeds or to refer to the whole Red Sea, especially the Gulf of Aqaba. People have come up with all sorts of different places for the crossing. I was just dabbling in that. One of the most credible things I've seen, although not to archaeologists, because right now you got to be careful when you read archaeology, because most archaeologists do not believe the Bible is true. Don't have to gasp. I mean, that's just a proven fact. You read Biblical Archaeology Review or any other journals, or read the things they write, and they buy wholeheartedly into all sorts of historical critical garbage that denies the Bible. So as a result, archaeologists are picking the place for the crossing that fits their preconception of what happened here, which is a non-miracle in their thinking. If you accept it being a miracle, it could be anywhere. Now, there's a lot of stuff. There's a site called arcdiscovery.com, and there are a lot of things on there that I scratch my head at a bit. And the guy, I'm not sure what his background is, but he lays out quite a credible case for fitting in with the Bible, the biblical account, that what we're talking about here, because we're going to hear about them, a lot of wildernesses here, where they're camping at the edge of the wilderness, and they're camping again at the edge of the wilderness. It's like, wait a minute. I thought he makes a strong case for what we are seeing here in chapters 13 and 14, is the crossing of the Sinai Peninsula, that the actual Red Sea crossing was across the Gulf of Aqaba, which was about 10 miles wide, which just the description of the site, I mean, you could look at this afterwards, but his photos of the site, he talks about this place called Wadi Watir and the beach at Nuweiba, which fits the biblical account exactly, where it is a wadi is a narrow dried up river, so it fits the account exactly that the children of Israel took a long turn in Pharaoh's mind and went down this wadi, that once you went down this wadi, you were stuck. You couldn't get easily out of it. So a lot of the other things in this account make sense if that were true. And like I said, I'm not going to climb on my horse and declare this is the place. But I'm just saying he's making an interesting case that if this were true, it does make a good case for what was going on here in Exodus, is that you're really talking about them entering the wilderness of Sinai in this first part of chapter 13 and exiting the wilderness of Sinai at the beach on the Red Sea at the beginning of chapter 14, and then the crossing feet into Arabia, because this identification of Mount Sinai as where it actually is very suspect. It's very suspect. There are like different candidates all over the place. And reading about some of the things, there's, I think, a much better candidate in Saudi Arabia than there is in the Sinai Peninsula. And this whole stuff makes sense. And if you've ever heard talk about finding chariot wheels and bones at the bottom of the Red Sea, well, that's at this site, Wadi Watir and the beach of Nuweiba, that's across from there. And there's other things about the bottom of the Red Sea, which makes it a likely place of crossing. It's like you've got almost a sandbar across the Red Sea, and on either side you have a sandbar. So it would be a perfect place for a crossing. So anyway, as far as my take on it, backing away from this one person's understanding of it, is that you have to believe the scriptural account, and you can't apologize for God. Right? You can't apologize for God by trying to water down the account to be more palatable to what people nowadays think could have happened. The biblical account says that this was such a great miracle that it found its way into all sorts of Jewish literature later on. As being, and these people have been through the plagues, and what stuck in their heads was the death of the firstborn and the crossing of the Red Sea. So we're not talking about the crossing of the Red Sea about some soggy trek across a marsh somewhere. We're talking about something that stuck in their heads. This is something that they told their children and their grandchildren about. This was something that was a miracle that was never seen before, I can't say never seen since, because there are other places where waters parted. And there was the actual entry into the Promised Land under Joshua, and then there was Elijah who parted the waters of the Jordan River. So there are other things that happened after that. Certainly, I would say maybe not on this scale, because I don't think the Jordan River was as far across as the Red Sea was. I don't think it was wide. So this was something that was bigger than that, but still. So these people were leaving Egypt and crossing to the Red Sea. Verse 19, Moses took the bones of Joseph with him. He had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones from here with you. I don't remember, I think it's in the Ten Commandments. To me, one of the most poignant scenes of leaving Egypt was them carrying Joseph's casket out, the bones of Joseph out of there. That most likely it was a little smaller than that, but anyway. The Egyptians, I guess if they embalmed him, it would have been a sarcophagus, but if they didn't, it would have been an ossuary, which is a small thing, taking it out. Verse 20, then they set out from Sukkot and camped in Etam on the edge of the wilderness. That's the first edge of the wilderness. The Lord was going before them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them on the way, and in a pillar of fire by night to give them light that they might travel by day and by night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day, or the pillar of fire by night, from before the people. That's what it was talked about in much more detail in Numbers chapter 9, about the cloud, and how when it went up, you got going, even if it was in the middle of the night. When it sat down, you unpacked, no matter where you were. Might not seem like good camping grounds to you, too bad. This is the place. So you can camp. So, and you almost wish that we had a cloud around our houses, you know, in our day, that we could follow. But bear in mind, they didn't have the Word of God written down. Moses hadn't written it yet, as far as we know. Now it's possible he could have written some things, as far as Genesis was concerned. But certainly he wasn't writing Exodus until after the Exodus was done. So none of the Word of God was written down. They had no guidance whatsoever except the traditions of their family. So as a result, God had to do something visibly for them so they knew where to go and what to do. There was no mistaking it. I mean, you couldn't argue, I didn't know which way to go. Excuse me, buddy. Turn around and look in the sky, would you? Oh, yeah. Okay, cloud. Follow the cloud. During the day, it looked like a cloud. During the night, it was fire. And it was there all the time. It was there every day. It was not like God had to go off somewhere and do something on the planet Venus and then come back. His presence was there all the time. Now, that wasn't really the presence of God. God is, you know, one of the doctrines of God is that He's omnipresent. But that was the manifestation of His presence. Was there. And later on, we saw in Numbers chapter 9, that when the tabernacle was erected, then that's where the presence would descend. It would descend onto and into the tabernacle. And the very root of that presence was the glory of God above the mercy seat. Right, in chapter 14, verse 1. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, tell the sons of Israel to turn back and camp before Pi-hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea. You shall camp in front of Baal-zephon, opposite it by the sea. And one of the reasons why people argue is that none of those place names are known nowadays. You've got to understand archaeology. Looking back all this length of time, you're really talking about mounds of dirt in the middle of the desert, okay, that archaeologists dig into. And unless there is a strong local tradition that that's the name, and even if there is a strong local tradition, archaeologists really can decide whether that's a credible tradition or not. I mean, this beach that this person talks about, Ark Discovery, this person, Wynn, I think his name is, there actually is a column set up there that commemorates the passage of Israel onto that beach, but archaeologists have to decide whether that's credible or not, or if there's somebody who had his own axe to grind. And even nowadays, you got to be careful because people will declare something to be an important archaeological site because they want the tourism, they want the money, and all the rest of it. So that's why archaeologists still are arguing about the location of this. The whole doctrine that it came up, that this was really this salty sea, this marshy place, was because people don't really trust the miracle. They don't trust the miracle. So here these people were heading for Canaan. And God tells them, turn off. So they turn. They turn off. And this is what I was saying, is that we had them camping, entering the wilderness. Now we have camping at the edge of the wilderness. Well, all that was important was the edge of the wilderness. Why didn't they just stay where they were? And so was they. The best explanation of this was that there were two sides of it. There were two sides of it coming into and out of the wilderness. Verse 3, so Exodus chapter 14, verse 3. For Pharaoh will say of the sons of Israel, they are wandering aimlessly in the land, the wilderness has shut them in. Thus I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will chase after them, and I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. And they did so. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his servants had a change of heart toward the people, and they said, what is this we have done, that we have let Israel go from serving us? Okay, so God says, turn off, I'm going to take you into a difficult place. I don't know that I would have been too enthusiastic about that, but Moses obeyed without question. He wasn't standing, but Canaan's that way, and you're taking us that way. He didn't argue with God. God said, turn. Moses said, okay. So he turned. And he's going down to possibly the worst place to be. The worst place to be, because the place that's bounded, it's shut in, it's bounded all around by the sea on one side, and I believe it implies that the mountains on the other. So they're kind of stuck. They're trapped, as we would say. They're trapped in this place. Now back in Egypt, verse 5 ought to start with, meanwhile, back in Egypt, God had just said he was going to harden Pharaoh's heart. And in verse 5 we show what happened. Remember that what Moses was asking for was to go worship God in the wilderness. And there was the idea of a 3-day journey in there to go worship God. I don't know that it really registered on Pharaoh that they weren't coming back. Possibly it sort of did, but maybe he was in denial over the fact they weren't coming back. That's why you read this verse, it sounds weird that Pharaoh told them to go and then he was angry that they'd fled. Most likely what had happened is that he gave them permission to go out for a time to serve God and then come back. And then his people came back and said, they went a lot longer than 3 days out. So most likely this is several days, maybe a week or so after the people left. It would be nice if it was 8 days, because then it would correspond with the Feast of Unleavened Bread, but unfortunately Scripture doesn't give us that nice little hook to hang our hats on. So at this point, probably what also contributed to that is they looked around and there's all this mud blocking piles and these hammers and things around and these brick-making forms. And the Egyptians are looking at each other saying, are you going to make the bricks? I'm not going to make the bricks. You going to make the bricks? I'm not going to make the bricks. And they kind of went back and forth for a while and said, well, who's going to get to make the bricks? I don't know. Let's go ask the officials. They went up and asked the officials, well, who's going to make the bricks? The officials said, I'm not going to make the bricks. They went and talked to their boss and they said, who's going to make the bricks? And they said, I'm not going to make the bricks. They went all the way up to Pharaoh and they said to Pharaoh, who's going to make the bricks? And he said, where'd the Jews go? He said, well, they left. Oh, yeah, that's right. I told them they could go. Okay, so who's going to make the bricks? I'll tell you what, maybe if we go get the Jews, they'll make the bricks again. Sounds like a plan. So in verse 6, so he made his chariot ready and took his people with him. And he took 600 select chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. Now bear in mind, it wasn't just 600 chariots. It was 600 elite chariots. It was the creme de la creme. These were his shock troops. These were his special forces chariots. The rest of the chariots are just regular old chariots, but you got to stop and understand that cavalry against people, especially unarmed civilians, is just there's just no comparison. You could easily take down 20, 30, 50 to 1 with chariots. That just it was unstoppable, especially the untrained people like this. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie, the Lord of the Rings trilogy. There's one great scene in there where you have mounted horsemen just charging down into infantry. It's sort of like a wave crashing on the beach. That's what horsemen were like to, cavalry was like to these people. That they're absolutely terrifying, particularly Egypt. I mean, chariots were Egypt's specialty. They were really good at that. So they're things to be scared of. It's like Abram's tanks rolling over the horizon. Right, or something that you don't mess with. Verse 8, the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he chased after the sons of Israel as the sons of Israel going out boldly. And the Egyptians chased after them with all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and they overtook them camping by the sea beside Pi-Hahiroth in front of Baal-Zephon. As Pharaoh drew near, the sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them. They became very frightened, so the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord. So it was terrifying. Especially if this is true about the Wadi, then there's no place to go. They were shut in, there's no place to go. They just had to stand there and watch the chariots approach. They couldn't run to one side or the other. So yeah, scared. This was really the first time that they themselves had to face Egyptian opposition. Right? Up to that point, Moses and Aaron were doing all the talking, God was doing all the fighting. They themselves just kept on doing what they were doing. They kept on being slaves, kept on making bricks. Life went on, they had to deal with all the stuff around them, but they themselves weren't called on to stand for anything, really. They just had to wait to be rescued, taken out. So now this is the first time that they themselves have to show some backbone. Right, here they are, they're looking up. They're going to prove God right in a minute. God said, I'm going to take them by the way to the Philistines because they're going to get scared, they're going to go back to Egypt. Verse 11, then they said to Moses, is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt? I laugh when I read verse 12. Is this not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. If I were Moses, I would have said, what? That's not how I remember it. I remember you crying out to God to be taken out of there. I don't remember any you telling me to leave you alone that you may serve the Egyptians. Now, you told me to leave you alone when things got tough there in the beginning, but after that, I think we're all on the same channel. We're all heading out. I mean, if you wanted to, I guess you could have just stayed, right? Nobody forced you to leave Egypt. You could have just stayed there. It was so great. But it's a credit to Moses that he didn't argue with the people. He didn't let them have it. Verse 13, but Moses said to the people, do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. I like that keeping silent part. Maybe he'd had enough of this complaining and whining about going back to Egypt or crying out to God. I don't think they were crying out to God, though. I'm looking back. No, they did cry out to God. They did cry out to God. So basically, you know, they cried out to God, but they had a little bit of wine with their prayer, which doesn't really go well. So he's like, God, the Lord will fight for you. It's like, come on, people, didn't you just go through the plagues? Death of the firstborn, remember that? I also like verse 15. The Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward. What I like about that is because just as there's a time for prayer and God assigns us our role in His kingdom based on our abilities, as we saw back in chapter 13, so there's a time when you pray enough, it's time to move. I've seen people err on both directions. I've seen people try to do something but never pray. And I've had people keep praying when they should be doing something. You know, the cloud has lifted and it's moving out briskly across the desert. And you're still sitting there wondering if it's time. It's very time. Get moving. There's time when you just stop. The praying is, it's no more time for pray. It's time to do. Don't get stuck. Either way, pray and move. Pray and move. So God tells Moses, look, you prayed enough. I told you, I'm going to help you. Go. Verse 16, as for you, lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, and the sons of Israel shall go through the midst of the sea on dry land. As for me, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, that they will go in after them. And I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and his horsemen. God forbid that he should ever have to honor himself that way in our lives. Because God is glorifying himself, showing that his justice is served and his power is exhibited in the life and death of Pharaoh and his army. Verse 18, then the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I am honored through Pharaoh, through his chariots, and his horsemen. The angel of God who had been going before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them. The pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them. That says that what we're talking about here is not a natural phenomenon. We're not talking about you know, just something that was randomly happening. We're talking about really the manifestation of the presence of God that had sentience and purpose to it. So when it served God's purpose for that manifestation to be in front of them, it was in front of them. When it served God's purpose for that manifestation to have their back, it had their back. It went before them and stood behind them. That would make most sense if there was some sort of a constrained entrance into this area that they were in. Because the first question that you have is, well, why didn't they just go around it? Well, they'd block the whole way. There's something else that happened too, verse 20. So it came between the camp of Egypt and the camp of Israel, and there was the cloud along with the darkness, yet it gave light at night. Thus the one did not come near to the other at night, all night. The implication is that on the Egyptian side, there was utter darkness. On the Israeli side, there was light. It reminds me of that, of the plague. That mysterious plague of the darkness that God had brought on Egypt. It almost sounds like something like that happened to the camp in Egypt. That they just didn't know where to go. They couldn't find their way. They couldn't figure out what direction to go in. So they just did not attack. They just stayed where they were. Verse 21, then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. And the Lord swept the sea back by a strong east wind all night and turned the sea into dry land. So the waters were divided. The sons of Israel went through the midst of the sea on the dry land, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Hello, this is not a marsh. This is not a marsh. This is not a puddle. This is not a little, you know, lake. This was the scene as it is pictured in the two movies that are the most famous, you know, Ten Commandments and Prince of Egypt, where you have them, the waters standing up like this massive wall on either side. If it was, if the crossing was at this location in the Red Sea, that this gentleman thinks it is, that the depth, the bottom of the sea in that area, it's like a mile down, although it slopes gradually down and gradually up. So you're talking about a mile wall of water on either side. So it's not just this little, you know, something that you can hop up and peek over. This was this massive wall of water on the right hand and to the left as they're walking through. Think about the faith it took for the first person to step into that. It just... I don't know who it was. You get the impression Moses took up the rear. Maybe it was Aaron going first. I don't know, but just to walk on dry land. Because the east wind all night was not only dividing the water, but drying out the seabed so that you didn't have this mucky, slimy, gooey thing that they're walking in, but dry land. Verse 23. Then the Egyptians took up the pursuit. As I used to say when John was growing up, my son, smart and not smart. Here we have not smart. Okay? Egyptians took up the pursuit, and all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen went in after them into the midst of the sea. Not smart at all. Not really smart at all. I mean, the Jewish people were motivated by faith. These people were motivated by hatred and bitterness and anger, and it still drove them into that canyon, that watery canyon. Didn't they learn their lesson? I guess not. I guess they weren't thinking at that point, or Pharaoh wasn't thinking. Verse 24, at the morning watch, the Lord looked down on the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud and brought the army of the Egyptians into confusion. He caused their chariot wheels to swerve and he made them drive with difficulty. So the Egyptians said, let us flee from Israel. The Lord is fighting for them against the Egyptians. It's probably several miles across. I don't want to sound like a broken record, but the crossing was in this particular spot. It was about 10 miles across. And it probably would have taken the people on foot a couple hours to cross. You would think 10 hours and 10 miles. Probably would have taken them like 4 or 5 hours, I would think. Because that many people walking, although they were much more fit than modern-day Americans, and much more used to walking. still, when you have old people and children and animals that you're leading and things like that, you probably are walking at 2 to 4 miles per hour is a comfortable walk. And so to go 10 miles, that was like 4 to 5 hours across. Now the Egyptians had chariots, but they not only had chariots, but they probably had foot soldiers too. And that's just a guess. Maybe it was all chariots, I don't know. If it was all chariots, then a chariot could go maybe 20 miles an hour, so it would take them about a half hour to get across. So you figure about 15 minutes in and 15 minutes out. If you go halfway, and they're out of here. And if the wheels swerve when you're halfway in, that's 5 miles on foot. And now that's a little over an hour for you to get out. But I guess if you're running to save your life, it might be a little faster. Verse 26, and the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, so that the waters may come back over the Egyptians, over their chariots and their horsemen. So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal state at daybreak, while the Egyptians were fleeing right into it. And then the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen, even Pharaoh's entire army that had gone into the sea after them. Not even one of them remained. So the sons of Israel walked on dry land throughout the midst of the sea, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. In case you missed it the first time, here he says it again. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. When Israel saw the great power which the Lord had used against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord. It didn't last, but they feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. About time, after all the plagues and everything else, but I mean, just to actually see that in front of you. The plagues were generally things that were small-scale sorts of things, you know, bugs in your house, and even the death of the firstborn. But to actually stand on the banks of the sea and watch this mile-high column of water collapse over the Egyptian army. And I don't know, didn't just watch, you know, I think the movies generally do it well, but this great turmoil of the waters as they are crashing back down together and then leaping up into waves and white crust until finally it all just settles down to a smooth sea again and no sign of the army. The greatest army in that part of the world at that time, I don't know what was going on in China or other places in the world, but certainly in that part of the world, in the Middle East, that was the superpower of that day. And there was nothing left of their army, their shock troops, the cream of the crop. And probably nothing left of Pharaoh, too. Although it doesn't explicitly say that. It's sort of implied that Pharaoh set off with them, that he was probably in the mix also. And this was important to the establishment of Israel, by the way, because Israel could do effective battle against the city-states in Canaan, but against the troops in Egypt. Now they had rest from the Egyptian army. They could go and conquer Canaan and not have to worry about what the Egyptians were going to do for decades after this. Because the Egyptian power was busted at this point. They weren't going to leave. They weren't going to bug Israel for a while. They weren't going to bother them for a while. Now later on in Israel's history, they did have some problems with Egypt, but not in the early years. Egypt's power was broken by this. One of the songs we'd sung, I said, was that when you trust in the Lord, what can man do to you? This was a prime example of that. Here we had the wrath of man versus the power of God. No, not even an even contest. Not even worth turning on the TV to watch. You know, this was going to be a shutout. This was going to be a no-hitter. God was going to triumph. He was going to take them out. But yet in our own lives, when we are threatened by far less than the rampaging chariots of the Egyptian army, we still cave in. And afterwards you say, well, why did you do that? Oh, I just couldn't help it. I just had to do it. No. No, you didn't. You follow God, and you trust Him to take care of you. And if there are consequences to be paid, pay them. If you stand up for God and you lose your job, stand up for God. If you stand up for God and there's turmoil in your family, stand up for God. Because God has the power to stand behind His commandments and take care of His people. Even to this extent. I mean, there are some things that modern science can do, but this isn't one of it. We couldn't do this. Even nowadays, we couldn't do this. We couldn't have the wall of water standing up like that. It was a miracle. Don't listen to these people who try to explain it away and try to find natural explanations for it. It was a miracle. Miracles don't need a natural explanation because that's the very definition of miracles. The definition of miracle is something that violates physical law, and this violated physical law. This was a tremendous miracle that stuck in their heads for a while. Stuck in their heads. Even centuries later, they were still extolling this crossing. And even nowadays, if it weren't for these people nowadays who try to explain it all away, we should be in just as much awe of what God did. Same God, same power. He's on our side, I hope. Let me put it another way. I hope you're on God's side, because He's on the side of His people. Always has been. Always will be. No matter how weird things get or look. Let's pray. Yes, God and Father, I thank You not only for preserving the account of what You did to the Egyptian army, but also for all the things You have done in our own lives, when impossible things happened in our lives to accomplish Your plan. Forgive us for times that we choked, we caved in, we ran away from the conflict, or worse yet, we fought on the wrong side because of fear for consequences. Continue to reassure us and give us the right words to say to encourage each other, that we might not run away or despair or long for the slavery of Egypt, but rather trust You and enjoy the great freedom that You have given to us, and look forward in great expectation and hope to the deliverance that will occur with the return of our Messiah Yeshua, not only in our own lives, but in the lives of our whole world, for Your ultimate glory. Amen.